do you have
to testify? Do we have a witness sign-up sheet? All right. Beth Fagan, is that correct? Beth Fagan. And I don't know if the archivist, Roy Turnbow, is here with you, if you want to testify together or separately. And if you'd state your name for the record and then tell us what you want to tell us.
Chairman, I'm Beth Englander-Vaugh, and I'm the Child Protective Services Manager with Children, Adults, and Families at the Department of Human Services. And I am here today to testify about the proposed language changes in Senate Bill 14 related to the retention of state records for substantiated and unsubstantiated child abuse reports, as well as the specific duties of the state archivist in terms of retention of those records and destruction of those records. The Department of Human Services does not object to SB 14 and the proposed language changes as they are written. The proposed language does bring Oregon's child abuse record retention practices in line with those of other states, as well as with the standards supported by the Child Welfare League of America. If you have any questions that I might be able to answer this morning, I'd be glad to try and answer those for you.
All right. Senator Ringdale and then Senator Ferriola.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the purpose of retaining the records? Is it to keep track of the potential offender? Is it to protect the victim or a combination of it? What is it?
Senator Minnis and Chair Minnis and Senator Ringo, the purpose of retaining records generally is a matter of preserving historical record patterns in order to both protect children from repeated abuse, as well as to provide a historical record for that child should they later come back and wish to have their record in order to secure treatment services.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
But it's focused on the child and treating a child. It's not tracking offenders.
No, we are tracking the record retention issue in order to assure child safety.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank
Senator,
you.
Senator Ferriola.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thanks very much. The record focuses on the child, but isn't it indexed under the offender?
The records that we retain, actually all of our case records are opened under the family name, and so they are retained underneath the name of the child's family. They're not indexed by the offender.
Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, I do have a bunch of questions on this. The bill as proposed eliminates or changes the retention period for records. The current statute is 75 years for a substantiated case and 30 years for an unsubstantiated case. Mr. Chairman, I'd like the definition of unsubstantiated.
Okay. I understand those definitions occur in your administrative rules.
Chairman and Senator Ferriola, that's correct. And unsubstantiated means that there was not a determination that abuse occurred. And I would be glad to provide the committee with a copy of those rules and the definitions.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know if under the Reporting Act, it's my impression that reports can be made anonymously. Is that the case?
Chairman and Senator Ferrioli, reports remain anonymous under the statute, the reporting statute. However, there may be occasions when it becomes necessary for the reporting party to become a witness in a juvenile court proceeding, and that may happen at the direction of the district attorney. And in that case, then it's the district attorney's office that's putting them on the witness list.
And, Mr. Chairman, reporters or folks that make reports are absolutely protected from any liability.
As long as the report is made in good faith.
So there are penalties for malicious reporting?
Council can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the report has to be made in good faith, or somebody would have to reasonably believe that what they're perceiving is what they're reporting, if they're doing so maliciously, and I think you have potential civil liability. And actually, they're making a report to the police, they could potentially be charged with a criminal charge for filing a false police report, which is unfortunately only a C misdemeanor.
And that is the case that could be charged with filing a false report?
Chairman, and Senator Perriello, that would be the case.
If the, Mr. Chairman, if the person that's the subject of the report knows the report's filed, is there any notification to the person who's been, who's had a report on? Do they have any reason to be notified? Are they told that there's this report on file?
Chairman and Senator Farioli, the practice is at this time that if a report is filed and we plan to open and conduct an assessment to determine whether or not a child is at risk of continued injury or harm, that the alleged perpetrator would be notified as part of the proceeding.
So if somebody filed an honest report, the alleged perpetrator would be notified?
Mr.
Chairman, if the if somebody files an anonymous report, the alleged perpetrator is notified.
Chairman and Senator Farioli, I'm sorry, I misunderstood the earlier question. If it's an anonymous, all of our the reports are filed anonymously with respect to the perpetrator finding out that they are subject of a report, unless, and I may not be making myself clear here, unless and until such time as we open that referral to conduct an assessment of child safety. If it is an anonymous report and, well, if it is a report, period, and the decision is made on the basis of the screening of that report when it enters into our system that the agency will not do anything further, then it would be a closed report at that point in time.
So, Mr. Chairman, the alleged perpetrator of an anonymous, named in an anonymous report on an unsubstantiated case would never be notified that they were under investigation or that there was a case that was potentially considered to be open. Is that correct?
If, in order to, Chairman and Senator Farioli, in order to make a determination of whether or not a case is unsubstantiated or substantiated, we would have had to have conducted an assessment of the referral
yes.
or the report.
Right.
And in that case, all parties involved should be given that information that a report has been filed.
So it's a routine practice, Mr. Chairman, that named alleged perpetrators are notified that there's some sort of investigation open.
Senator, I don't think that would be the case, at least in my experience. There may be allegations of child abuse that do not rise to the level of the case being assigned to an investigator. Those records, if I'm understanding the bill correctly, would be retained for 20 years, but there would have been no investigation, so hence there may not have been a notification of a listed suspect. So,
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that clarification. You got to the heart of the matter I was aiming at. There are people walking around in Oregon who have been named as perpetrators where there's been no substantiated report and where the issue has been closed at a very low level, that not only do not know this, they've never been notified, but that the record is retained by the state of Oregon for 40 years in its archive system under current statute. 30 years, excuse me, Mr. Chairman. And I guess then the next line of questioning is very brief, Mr. Chairman, if you'll indulge me.
Sure.
Who has access to these records?
Chair Menace and Senator Farioli, what I will need to do is get back to you with that information. I'm relatively new in my position and would need to check out how access is handled other than when a field office requires or needs a record if there is a new referral in a family. And certainly that office then can request that record from archives if it has been sent to Salem for storage. Other than that, there was not clear language about how anyone else might access a record to include the subject of the report, who may be a child or an adult child, their family, or another party who may be given authorization to access the record. So I would need to get back to you on that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to suggest that what we're here going to hear back is that field offices have access, law enforcement personnel have access, social workers have access, security investigations for job clearance people that are looking at character may have access. I'd like to know.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, at least as far as the agency that I work for, all sex abuse investigations and child abuse investigations are confidential, and that material can only be released by the investigator or that investigator's supervisor or the clerk of the records in the Portland Police Bureau. So I wouldn't doubt that there are some other statutes that govern the confidentiality of that, but we do want to know what that is. So.
And then final question, Mr. Chairman. The State Archivist is obligated to remove these documents from the files. And there's a schedule in rule in this department that proceeds below the level that we see in statute, and there's some procedures. My understanding is that they are not routinely removed from the archives, ever.
Chairman Nissen, Senator Farrelly, again, that was a section of the proposed language in the rule with respect to ultimate expunction and destruction of records that, given the short time frames that we had to prepare for the hearing, we did not have a chance to research. And again, I would like to have the opportunity to do that and get back to you with that information.
I think the good part about public hearings is you start rooting out some of these issues and seeing where people have concerns.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the Senate Bill 14. I think it's a step in the right direction. I think it does not go nearly far enough. I think we really need to think hard about why the state of Oregon's keeping unsubstantiated reports for 30 years, or why we're keeping unsubstantiated reports for a day. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have my own opinions about that, but I won't share them at this point.
Okay,
I wanted to ask the question, is this a DHS bill, or whose bill is it?
Chairman, I don't know. It's not.
So do we know where it came from? Is it a bar bill? Is it a
this, Chairman, this was actually handed to me yesterday to do the research,
okay.
And so I'm not aware. I don't have that information at this point.
All right. Because I was going to ask the question why they're deleting the language on lines 24 through 27, where there's a kind of a statement of purpose for the retention of the records. So.
And, Chairman, I'm not able to answer that at this time.
All right. Anyone else have a question? Senator Ringo.
I guess I just want to step back for a minute, and you probably said this and I missed it, but what is the basic purpose you're proposing this? Is this just so you have to keep fewer records?
Chairman and Senator Ringo, actually, this is not a bill that was proposed by the department, but we are here in support of it.
Okay.
In order to recognize the reduced period of time for retention of records.
But one of the things you said is this brings us in line with other states. I mean, is
correct.
The goal here just to reduce the amount of paperwork or electronic files we're keeping?
Chairman Nissen, Senator Ringo, without having done further research, I'm not really clear and can't respond as to what the goal was in terms of changing the number of years that are currently on statute. However, this would reduce substantially the amount of time for retention of substantiated and unsubstantiated
right.
records and would still provide for the period of time needed to preserve a historical pattern for
mm-hmm.
that family. Other states at this point in time, the sister states that are nearest to us, and I'm thinking of Washington, Idaho, California, have records retentions that are significantly less
okay.
than Oregon's.
Well, Mr. Kerr, just as a comment, I guess I would really like to know what is the purpose, and maybe the council can inform us. Is it just to reduce the record keeping for the state?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I do not know what the purpose is, and I understand the state archivist is here and may be able to shed
okay.
some light on that,
okay.
but I could do some research if he cannot and get back to you on that.
Okay.
But I believe it was to bring Oregon law into compliance with the child abuse reporting law.
Okay, thank you.
I must be somewhat complicit in this, too, because I was co-chair of the Interim Judiciary Committee, and it was introduced by that committee. We had a very liberal policy for bills.
It seemed like a good idea.
Is that a substantiated or an unsubstantiated report, Mr. Chairman?
It's an admission of sorts of culpability. Any other comments, any other questions on members of the committee? Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Turnbow, if you're...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Roy Turnbaugh, and I'm the state archivist. This does seem to be kind of a mystery bill this morning because it caught me by surprise as well when I was reading through the roster of bills. I'm here to speak in support of it because I think that a reduction in the extremely long retention period in the statute is in fact appropriate. I might be able to provide you with a little bit of background on how that 75-year retention occurred, because I was around when ORS 192 was amended. And as I recall, it came at a time when repressed memory syndrome was very big, and I believe people who had been victims of abuse as children came in and testified that because of repressed memories coming to the surface many years later, the retention for these records needed to be extended much, much farther than it currently was. So I certainly don't have a problem with reducing the retention. 40 years, I think, is appropriate, if not on the long side. I would like to point out that the assumption that these records are in the custody of the State Archives is simply not true. The State Archives holds permanently valuable records. These records aren't permanently valuable. Evidence of that is the fact that they have a retention less than permanent. So these are records that would remain in the custody of the agency, and they would be access to these records would come through the agency. The only role that the Archives Division might have would be to house some of them in the State Records Center, which is a low-cost storage facility for inactive records. So I do think that if you decide to proceed with this bill, it should be amended to read the Department of Human Services instead of the State Archivist, to reflect the actual practice in dealing with these records.
Let me ask you a question about the current law, because it says, except as otherwise provided by law, the State Archivist, that's you, may grant to public officials of the state or any political subdivisions defined by 192, blah, 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 specific or continuing authorization for retention. The language there implies that there's a process by which you make an assessment that it's fine to keep the records there. Do you do that?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. That's exactly what I do. This is an exception to that process.
So is there a document, for instance, say the Portland Police Bureau, the agency I work with, they would have records relevant to this?
They would. Mr. Chair, they're called schedules or retention schedules. The Portland Police Bureau has its own retention schedule that's authorized by me that entitles it to destroy certain records when their useful life has passed. And it instructs the police bureau to retain other records which have more significant value. That's a document that I work with the city records program through the city auditor's office and with the police bureau.
Okay, and that applies to the various police reports, et cetera, that they have. But then with respect to child abuse reports, substantiated, unsubstantiated, I'm assuming that they currently comply with the rules here, the 75.
Mr. Chair, these are an exception. These are pulled out of my sphere of authority and put into the statute. So it is, in effect, it is removed from my jurisdiction.
Well, hang on just a second. The language, I'm assuming the italicized language is not italicized in law. Obviously, it is the law. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of flexibility for child abuse records on your part. It doesn't look to me like you can grant a lesser period of time.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I have no authority, no retention and disposition authority over the records that are enumerated in this statute. I did until the law was amended, right. I believe in 93, and they were pulled out and put into specific language in statute.
I see. Okay. So the law is the law, and you don't do anything. You have an assumption that all the agencies comply.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? All right. The information I've gotten from counsel is that we think this bill originated with former Senator Neil Bryant.
Oh.
So that's the, at least we have some circumstantial evidence that it may have been that.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bryant, the formerly Honorable Neil Bryant, in fact served on a task force that looked at this issue and made some recommendations. And my understanding from a kind of an oblique communication from his office is that this bill does reflect some of the recommendations, but not all of the recommendations. And I'll go ahead and contact Senator Bryant and ask him if he would look at this bill and communicate with the committee regarding the work of that work group.
Okay. It looks to me like this bill needs some time. It's going to have to go anywhere at all. So we'll set this thing over and ask counsel to hold the Senator Bryant. Do you think this has some profit in it, some benefit?
Mr. Chair, I believe that a reduction of that 75-40 retention is, you know, it's very appropriate to bring that. That's a really long, long time to keep these records.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. We'll close the public hearing on 14, and we'll move to public hearing on 38. And hopefully we have a sign-up sheet there or not. Do you have it here? Okay. All right. Robin Pope, Brady State Bar. Are you John Challey?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chairman Minnis. I'm Robin Pope. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I am the chairperson of the Oregon State Bar Standing Committee on Adoption, and I'm also a member of the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys. And my colleague, John Challey, is here with me.
And my practice is focused on adoption, and I have some testimony to present as well.
You want to start?
Yes, thank you. I'm going to let my testimony, written testimony, speak for itself and would ask that it become part of the record today, and then just make a few brief comments and respond to any questions you might have. Our concern is that since 1999, when the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Enforcement Act was passed by the Oregon Legislature, we have had some questions, ambiguities, and issues regarding adoption jurisdiction in the state of Oregon. And it is primarily when there are two states involved. So if a child is born in another state and the adoptive parents live here in Oregon, or vice versa, the child is born in Oregon and the adoptive parents are from another state. There is a case that Mr. Challey will address in which he was involved. Our concern is that we need a jurisdiction statute in Oregon that specifically addresses adoption issues. And the UCCJEA does not specifically address adoptions and their uniqueness, because there are unique issues involved in adoption. And what we are trying to do with Senate Bill 38 is to address those issues and provide modifications that will take care of the problems in jurisdiction in adoption cases here in Oregon. We are not trying to create a situation where just anybody can come to Oregon, fly in, adopt a baby, and fly out. That is not what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, we could get the Oregon Health Plan to cover that one.
we're trying to make sure that Oregonians, both birth parents and adoptive parents, have a sound jurisdictional basis when they have an adoption here in the state of Oregon. And the reason for a sound jurisdictional basis is that adoptions are so important. We are forming families, and we want to make sure that when those families are formed, that Oregon has the jurisdiction, that there isn't a question or ambiguity about that jurisdiction, and that other states will give our adoptions full faith and credit. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
knowledge of the history is when the 99 legislature adopted the Uniform Act?
The UCCJEA, we've had the UCCJA prior to that, and then in 99 they made revisions and adopted the new Model Act. And the UCCJEA, if you look at the Model Act, specifically excludes adoptions, and I attached some commentary from the committee to my testimony, both on the UAA and on the UCCJEA, where they say adoption was specifically excluded from the UCCJEA.
Do you have any idea why the 99 legislature chose to include it?
I'm not sure. I was not here so for that particular issue.
Right.
Thank you. That really is the overwhelming fact in what has to be the starting place, is that the UCCJEA was never intended to deal with adoptions, and so that the Uniform Act, before it was changed in Oregon, actually excludes adoptions. And the reason for that is that NCUSL, the organization who writes those acts, originally was hoping that in addition to the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act, that the states would also adopt the Uniform Adoption Act. So that when preparing this, it was my original intention to ensure that we did nothing in this act that was other than the jurisdictional elements of the Uniform Adoption Act. Now, there was one change that I made consistently to that, and apparently not consistently enough, and that was to require that those taking advantage of Oregon law be residents of this state for 6 months prior to the time that the petition for adoption was filed. Now, clearly it states that to be the case with respect to jurisdiction based upon the residency of adoptive families. Clearly it states that with respect to residency relative to birth families, birth mothers and birth fathers. What it doesn't do, and I understand to be an objection by several people, including the state, is that it doesn't clearly state that, with respect to agencies, raising the specter that we could do here three state adoptions. And three state adoptions would be ones where you have a birth mother in Utah, an adoptive family in California, deciding they want to take advantage of Oregon law, everybody coming to Oregon, and using that as a basis for jurisdiction. This act is a basis for jurisdiction doing an adoption, which really doesn't have anything to do with the state of Oregon.
You get them signed up for the health plan when you do.
Well, you know, that very literally that's one of the difficulties.
Exactly.
And we never meant to do that. We don't want to do that here. And what I would like to do is invite Kathy Ledesma from Department of Human Services. Certainly, to the extent that you've had experience with Ms. Ledesma, you know that she doesn't need me to articulate her position on anything. What I do want to underline, however, is that to the extent that that is a problem and a concern, I think that can be resolved in very short order by conferring with Ms. Ledesma.
Chairman, as members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma. I am the adoptions manager at the Oregon Department of Human Services, and I thank Mr. Challey for inviting me to the table with him this morning. We did contact yesterday the committee administrator to let you know that we are in opposition to this bill at the present time. However, we would like very much to not let that opposition stand as is, and would like to have the opportunity to talk more with the authors of the bill and with our legal counsel so that we can better understand both what the intention is and to eliminate any possibility for unintended consequences of this bill. As Mr. Challey said, what we really don't want to do is go back to a pre-1999 and pre-1993 time in which Oregon was a magnet for every adoption that happened out there. According to our records, there last calendar year, there were over 1,900 children who could have been affected by this change in legislation. And we want to make sure that we are not leaving any loopholes so that we don't have any children that are unprotected and that we don't have any possibility of violating any parental rights.
All right, thank you for that. Senator Farrell.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to have some background on the number of adoptions in Oregon and the trends, if that would be possible. I'm sure there's a statistical review that the department publishes. I'd like to get a copy of that or get a walkthrough on that. I have several acquaintances that have sought adoptions in Europe after having encountered the adoption process in Oregon. And, you know, they were desirous of adopting children and building families, came to the process, found it to be interminable and Byzantine, and went other routes to find a way to build a family. And, you know, it won't do any good for the committee to hear the comments about what I think of those, their desire and the quality of those parents and the families that they built. But I guess I'd like to know if there is trending in the statistics, whether Oregon is in tightening up its adoption rules so it didn't become a magnet state for adoptions, didn't maybe go too far in making that process difficult. Balancing that with the idea that you don't want adoptions to occur that don't create good, solid, stable environments for kids.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Good suggestion, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is Ms. Mendoza going to be testifying? She submitted written testimony.
She is on the list.
Okay, because she raises some very good questions that I'm going to want answered, and I'll just let you know up front that I'm very, very particular about adoption statutes in Oregon, and it goes back to some personal experience. So I have a lot of issues with this bill. I have concerns that we could set up this three-state thing that you've talked about. Mm-hmm. And my issue goes back to surrogate parenting. And we could have an issue where, because Oregon does not have a law prohibiting surrogate parenting, it's against public policy. That's as good as we could ever get in the state of Oregon in 1985 or 86, I believe. So we could have a situation where people could come to this state, pay a birth mother to have children, and they can come from different directions and take the child. I'm not going to sit here on this committee and allow that to happen. So I'm very concerned about some of the provisions in this bill. So
Chair would take that to mean you are no on this.
So far, okay. Yeah.
Keen sense of the obvious.
Would I be able to respond briefly?
Yes.
Okay.
Please.
The scenario that you just suggested, Senator Walker, is one that actually under current law, it could happen. Someone could have a baby here in Oregon, and someone from out of state can come and adopt that child under the current law. What we're trying to do is make sure that the jurisdiction basis for adoptions in Oregon is sound. And right now there is ambiguity and question both on the practitioner level and also from the Court of Appeals in the Bone case that we mentioned in our written testimony. I would briefly like to address, if I could, some of the concerns raised by Ellen Mendoza. Her written
testimony. Why don't we have her testify?
Okay. Would we be able to come back and respond briefly to that?
You can respond. I love these kind of debates.
Oh, thank you very much, Chairman.
And could I request before you leave that some of you come in to...
Senator Walker has another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Could you come into my office and sit with me and talk about this bill?
I would be delighted to do that. I brought my calendar, and I can just set a specific time, and I will come, Senator Walker.
I would appreciate it because I'm very interested in protecting the birth
and
mothers.
I remember working with you last session on a different bill, and it was a very positive.
Senator Walker is going to be the subcommittee chair on adoption. All right. If we could have Ms. Mendoza come up and testify.
Thank you.
Opportunity to respond if you
choose. I would also like to have the opportunity to respond to Ms. Mendoza's comments.
Okay, that's fine. Ms. Mendoza?
Good morning. My name is Ellen Mendoza. I'm an attorney who practices in Oregon City. I have spent 20 years working at Legal Aid, and normally... I believe Ms. Senator Burdick has requested that I provide information regarding this act and how it would affect our clients through a letter that was recently written. Am I correct, Ms. Burdick, Senator Burdick?
I believe that's correct.
Thank you. Okay. I don't do adoptions. I get involved in adoptions infrequently when birth parents want to try to take back the decision they made at some point. So I am not an adoption expert per se. My business is not facilitating adoptions. My connection to this issue is in looking at how adoptions have been done after the fact and seeing whether they comply with the laws that are in effect, either in Oregon or the state that that my clients have come from. So I definitely come from a different perspective. I am the attorney on McCulley v. Bone, the other attorney besides Mr. Challey. So Mr. Challey and I have had several arguments in court and out of court about this issue. And again, I don't want to read my testimony. Those provide some of the highlights of my concerns about this issue. But I do want to address a couple of things that I think are important. First of all, Senator Ferrioli, you made several comments about, and they'll be on the Oregon Health Plan, I suppose, too, if they come into Oregon. And I just want to relate to you that even under the law as currently written, that happens, and that has occurred earlier this year in a case that Mr. Challey and I were involved in. Mr. Challey did not orchestrate this particular scenario, so I'm not pointing the finger at him, but he knows well what this case is about. And the point is that in that case, an adoption attorney in Oregon convinced a Washington resident to move to Oregon, get on the Oregon health plan, give birth, and then the child was given up for adoption to a New Jersey couple. And although there were many things that were disturbing about that case, the one thing that turned out right is that the Oregon court and the New Jersey court agreed that jurisdiction for that adoption, if it is to be finalized, which it looks like it's ending up going to happen that way, is going to be in New Jersey, because that's the one place that someone lived for a while, the adoptive parents. So even under our current situation, there is the scenario of Oregon being a magnet for adoptions. And why is that? It's because Oregon, in other respects that have nothing to do with this bill, has adoption-friendly laws. It is easier in a lot of ways to finalize an adoption and make it irrevocable in Oregon than in other states. So you have personal experience of people who've had trouble getting adoptions through in Oregon, and you know, there are always, you know, fact patterns that do cause trouble. But in many situations, Oregon is an easy state to get an adoption. This bill will make it even easier, because this bill will remove the idea of a priority of decision making for jurisdiction. The UCCJEA was passed in 99. Before that, we had the UCCJA. And the main difference between those two acts is that in the UCCJA, there were about four or five ways that you could assert a state had jurisdiction. One of them was child has lived here for 6 months, and that is by far the most common scenario. But if that scenario isn't advantageous to your case, you can go on and assert, well, child has a substantial connection to this state, or child just happens to be here, and you know, no other state is available. The UCCJEA, besides putting into effect a whole bunch of very useful procedures for how two states should coordinate their decision making in these kind of cases, also lists a preference for home state jurisdiction. So if a child has lived somewhere for either 6 months, or if they're less than 6 months old, wherever they've lived since birth, then that state wins. That state is the state that has jurisdiction. And what this bill would do is take away that priority, and it would leave it open to interpretation by whoever happens to be interpreting. It could be the attorney who wants to do the adoption. It could be a judge that, you know, is looking at a contest. It leaves it open to choose among five possibilities what jurisdictional basis we should use. And that's a situation that breeds litigation. And it is going to breed litigation. And it's going to, and what concerns me, and I've seen this in the McCulley v. Bone case, is that when you have prospective biological parents who are thinking about adoption, they don't know the laws of another state. and they may know something about their own laws. So you can't assume that a biological parent is coming into Oregon because they like those laws. And when they want to second-guess their decision, which is very hard to actually do and be successful at, but a biological parent should have the right to at least come into court and say, hey, I'm the mom, and I don't think this went down right. I mean, I'm just talking about the right to come into court. You have to give them a halfway decent chance of knowing where the right court is and not fool around for 6 months or 2 years, like basically happened on McCulley v. Bone, figuring out what court should have jurisdiction. So there was, the UCCJEA, I think by all family law practitioners, is a great improvement over the UCCJA because it has that priority and it has a wealth of provisions on how states should communicate with each other. There have been numerous cases in Oregon and all over the country that have said that adoption cases are custody cases subject to the UCCJA. And although it's true that the UCCJEA, in its Uniform Act, excluded adoptions, the decision was made by the 99 legislature to put adoptions in. And I believe Senator Minnis asked, why? What brought that on? And the reason that happened, and I you know, I don't have a piece of legislative history, but I have Maureen McKnight, who was the one who argued and successfully convinced the legislature at that time that adoption should be included, is because there was nothing else for adoptions at that time. There have already been Oregon Supreme Court cases that said adoptions are covered under the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act. It's just a very small step to say, okay, we'll also cover them under the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Enforcement Act, the UCCJEA. And Ms. McKnight successfully said, basically, you need to put these in because otherwise there is no jurisdictional law covering them. Now, this bill is proposing to be the substitute for the UCCJEA. What will happen if it passes? You will have the country operating under the UCCJEA for most custody cases, and us, and what I found is that there are four other states that have the same jurisdictional requirements that this bill proposes, us having a completely different system, which to me is bound to lead to problems where some states may not honor Oregon adoptions. Ms. Pope suggests that this will produce security, finality, and adoption. I think it's going to be the opposite, that a state, for example, the state of Arkansas, where my client, Ms. Bowen, lived for 6 months and the child lived for 6 months, the state of Arkansas may not honor that adoption because under their law, they may say, no, we should have done the adoption all along, so the Oregon adoption decree is no good as far as we're concerned. And so if for any reason that adoption was challenged in Arkansas, we're not going to honor it. So the whole point of having uniform acts is to have uniform application statewide. UCCJEA is the way things are going. The Uniform Adoption Act, I don't think, is going to be enacted nationwide. One state has enacted the whole thing, as far as I can tell from my research, and that's Vermont. When you go on the Internet and you look under the Uniform Adoption Act, there are like 40 sites that call it the Evil Act. And the reason that it's called the Evil Act is because it has extremely stringent records protections laws, the exact opposite of Oregon's Open Adoption Act records law. And so although it may have been a good exercise in scholarship to come up with that act, the world's not going that way in terms of adoptions, at least, you know, for the issue of open records. And so the idea that we're all going to adopt the Uniform Adoption Act, I just don't think we're going to see that. And I have to point out something else, and to me this is probably the most important part about this bill, that if by chance this bill goes through, that at least the part that says adoption agencies can be considered basically as the resident for purposes of jurisdiction. That provision was taken out 10 years ago. We used to have that, and it caused problems. In 1993, the legislature took that out and said, no, where the adoption agency is cannot be a basis of jurisdiction. This puts it back in. So the three-state scenario certainly can occur under this law. If we have an Oregon adoption agency with, you know, a substantial connection to the state, people can fly in, sign their adoptions, and fly out. This is not going to prevent adoptions. This may mean that adoptive parents in Oregon, when looking at a child in another state, have to hire a lawyer in another state and do that adoption where the child is born. That's not hard to do. That just means you pay a different lawyer. And I think that we should follow the UCCJEA. It is a nationwide methodology for looking at all custody cases. And plenty of times adoption cases have other custody cases attached to them. For example, it's very common to start an adoption case by getting a guardianship. Guardianships are under UCCJEA. We're going to have two laws in every case sort of, you know, clunking around. And I just think that there's no evidence in the appellate decision, certainly, and I haven't heard any trial court evidence, that this UCCJEA is not working for adoptions. I think it is. I think it provides a framework. And just, you know, earlier this year, John Challey and I had a case where two states applied UCCJEA in adoption and came to a sensible decision that we could all live with. So, you know, like I said at the end, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I stick with that.
Senator Brew.
Thank you. You mentioned that four other states had laws like this bill would put in.
Right.
In Oregon.
Right.
But what are those four states?
Vermont, North Carolina, California, and Oklahoma. And you know, there may be other states that have different provisions from the Uniform Adoption Act that aren't the jurisdictional issues. I did a search that just looked for the language that was similar to the bill, and those are the ones I came up with. I can't guarantee those are absolutely accurate, but that's what I found in my research.
The things that you warn about if this bill were to pass, have you documented those in the four states where it's in effect?
No. I have not had a chance to look at it. I think the California passage is very, very new. And I think the Vermont is the only state that enacted the whole act. The whole act is very comprehensive, but if you don't take it all, if you just take pieces of it, and the whole act came before. The Uniform Adoption Act was drafted before the UCCJEA was drafted. So when you look at the commentary, and Ms. Pope's testimony includes some of the commentary, it refers to the UCCJA. So it had not anticipated the change of having the JEA, as far as I can tell, when they drafted the act. And that was in 94.
All right. So I like this committee. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. In the written testimony by Robin Pope, it states that in the McCleavy Bone case, the Court of Appeals recommended adoption of the Uniform Adoption Act.
McCulley v. Bone, the judges in a footnote made reference to the fact that UCCJEA was on its way and that it didn't include adoptions because of the Uniform Adoption Act. The judges did not know, or it may not have even happened at that point, that the UCCJEA in Oregon included adoptions. So the judge was, I think, thinking in her mind, I think it was Justice Linder, we'll be having the UCCJEA, and it would be nice if we had the Uniform Adoption Act since UCCJEA doesn't include adoptions. It's a footnote. It's not relevant to the decision, and in fact, the only thing that the biological parent lost in that case was jurisdiction, exactly because we didn't have a home state priority. If it had been crystal clear that there was a home state priority under our law, we wouldn't have even had that case here.
But I guess do you agree, though, that the judge in that case recommended that the legislature adopt the Uniform Adoption Act?
No, I don't think it went that strong.
Okay.
I mean, it made reference to it, but didn't say do this instead of putting it in UCCJEA. They just assumed it wouldn't be in, under UCCJEA.
Okay. Thank you.
I mean, you know, you look at the dictum and see what you see. It's a footnote.
All right. So your argument is that the Uniform Adoption Act is not being adopted by a vast majority of states.
That's right.
And you're suggesting that more likely than not not be adopted.
Right, right. Okay. You know, there's so many cases under the UCCJEA and JA. I mean, there's a whole wealth of jurisdictional cases that, that everyone can draw on when you have a custody contest. If we go with this bill, all those cases will be irrelevant and we'll just be talking in the dark. And it will just lead to a lot of impromptu decision making by judges and, right, and lawyers.
Great. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mendoza, could I ask you also to make an appointment to come and see me? I'd like to do quite a bit of research on this bill.
I'd be glad to. Sure.
And I just need to speak with you a little more.
Okay,
thank
great.
You.
Thank you.
And Ms. Ledesma as well.
Okay.
All right. Ms. Pope and Mr. Celli, do you want to respond?
Chair, I feel like we're a court here listening to competing arguments.
And that's why I like this committee. I love it when the lawyers are smart start going at each other.
I'm uncomfortable doing this sitting down. That's the which is the other requirement.
Well, I'm uncomfortable without my court reporting machine, so there we go.
Well, one of the points that I think that needs to be made most strongly is that we are different from every other state that has adopted the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act. It is just the opposite than that which has been represented by Ms. Mendoza. We are different because every other state that's adopted the UCCJEA has excluded adoptions from the Act itself, which was the intent of the original Act. Looking at specifics, when you look at the case of McCauley versus Bone, that was a case where you had a birth mother in Arkansas who placed her child knowingly, meaning she knew the family, she met the family, she knew that it was an Oregon family, she signed Oregon consents for an adoption with the understanding that the adoption was going to be completed in the state of Oregon. This act would clearly allow the completion of that adoption in the state of Oregon, as did previous law.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair? The adoptive parents lived in Oregon?
Yes. Okay. Long-term residents of the state of Oregon. And so the context of this is that you have a judge, whether it be in Arkansas or Oregon, being asked to consider the current circumstances of a child and the future care, which is the issue in every adoption proceeding. How's the kid doing now? How's the child doing now? And how is the child going to be doing in the future? What kind of care can this family provide? And it just seems overwhelmingly logical that the courts in the state of Oregon, where the child physically was at the time of filing the petition for adoption, that knows the family, meaning it has all the information concerning the individual background of the adoptive parents, is the most appropriate place for determining how this child is going to be treated in the future. Now, one of the suggestions is that somehow there's a problem with the Uniform Adoption Act in general. And I can't tell you how much I dislike the Uniform Adoption Act in general. I don't like it, don't want it for the state of Oregon. I would be testifying against it if it were ever to come before this committee or any other. What we did, though, is wanted to clarify the jurisdictional issues. And I can tell this committee that I cannot think of a category of cases where adoptions could be completed in this state after passage of this act that are not already being done, with the possible exception of the three state adoptions, and I think both Ms. Pope and I have been as clear as we possibly could on that issue. We don't want the three state adoptions. We don't like the three state adoptions. Neither she or I did the three state adoptions when we could because we thought they were inappropriate, and we can take that off the table with a change in the draft. Now, after saying that we don't like the Uniform Adoption Act generally, it is a basis for jurisdiction. And the reason that when drafting this act to begin with, we relied heavily on the Uniform Adoption Act is that it was designed to dovetail with the UCCJEA. That was the intention of its jurisdictional elements. So first point is there is nothing that the state of Oregon in adopting the UCCJEA did something that I know of no other state that's done, and that is every other state excludes adoptions, we included adoptions. Secondly, we use the UAA, the Uniform Adoption Act, only in its jurisdictional with its jurisdictional elements because they were meant to dovetail with the UCCJEA. I maintain strongly that that this is agenda free. There's nobody in this committee who would accept that. I do have an agenda. I want to focus on that agenda. That agenda is to make adoptions predictable for birth parents and adoptive families in the state of Oregon. So when the placement occurs, people know what's going to happen. There's jurisdictional clarity. And I'm not placed in the situation where I'm constantly placed today. When I'm dealing with any interstate adoption, my first statement is I want you to know that jurisdictional issues, this is to the client, the jurisdictional issues in the context of adoption are the most complex questions in adoption law today, and they're the least predictable. Second question is in any case involving two states, there is no certainty whether jurisdiction exists in one state or the other. This is going to clarify this so that when that child is placed with the adoptive family, the birth mother, the adoptive family, and at some level the child can take security in that new relationship. That is the agenda. And with respect to others in other places, I'm so willing to either answer the questions and concerns or, as we've discussed with the issue of three-state adoption, which we never meant to introduce as an issue anyway, we can withdraw that simply by making sure very, very clear in the next draft that that's not part of anybody's agenda. It's desired by nobody that I know of. It's being pushed by no one. The agenda is simple. I want this committee to know that a significant portion of my practice is representing birth mothers. I have been known as a birth mother advocate for years in the adoption world in the state of Oregon. I appreciate the problems that they have, and that what we find is the birth mothers living in this state want to take advantage of the laws of the state of Oregon. They like the state of Oregon. How come? Because one of the most attractive aspects of Oregon law with respect to adoptions is that they can have an open adoption. Some birth mothers, this is the most important aspect to them of the placement. And it makes so much sense to me on a personal basis that I went ahead and started an agency, Open Adoption and Family Services, that's focused on specifically that issue. We want to have a birth mother who places her child in Oregon be able to look at an adoptive family from the state of Washington, better example, state of California, and say, I want to have an open adoption. I want to have it enforceable, which I can do under Oregon law, and I want the protection of Oregon law and other issues as well, and to provide that for them. If you look at the interests of birth parents in total, as opposed to just one specific case where, as in the Bone case, where the birth mother places with an Oregon family, she knows it's going to be an Oregon adoption, she knows Oregon law is going to apply, and she decides she's unhappy with the circumstances and wants to revoke her consent. We can always find individual examples where people are unhappy with any statute that this legislature passes. The fact is, though, that if you look at the total experience of adoptive families, What you find and birth families is that they're going to be looking at wanting Oregon to law to apply. And when I'm talking about Oregon families. I'm talking about Oregon birth mothers. And the fact is that they can get more out of Oregon law than they can get out of law in many other states. And it just simply makes sense for them to be able to take advantage of this state's laws. Oregon citizens taking advantage of this state's laws. This is what the statute was meant to do. I believe in large part it does do that. And the one problem that's been pointed out to me today with regard to that, we can close by making it a requirement that all people taking advantage of this statute be Oregon residents, or that there be an Oregon resident involved in each adoption. Thank you for your consideration.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chow. I appreciate that. And Ms. Pope, do you have comments?
I just have some brief comments. One, I'd like to concur with what Mr. Chowley has added, and then add to the advantages to birth parents in Oregon. I think Senator Walker probably recalls I was here last session and was on behalf of our bar committee. A bill was passed that provides for counseling, pre-consent and post-consent for birth parents. And so I'm not here just on behalf of adoptive parents. I also represent birth parents in adoptions as well as adoptive parents. I am thinking about Oregon residents when I'm here and putting forth my position. Senator Minnis, you asked me earlier about why were adoptions included in the 1999 legislature on the UCCJEA, and Ms. Mendoza, in her testimony, stated that Maureen McKnight, who worked for Oregon Legal Services at that time, added adoptions to the UCCJEA because she said if we don't, then there's no jurisdiction law out there for them. I suggest that it was an oversight that adoptions got added, that it's an issue that wasn't thoroughly considered at the time, and we are now back asking that you thoroughly consider this issue and not just add it as an extra thing because we're worried there's nothing there, so we'll throw it in here. Throwing it in here into the UCCJEA throws it into a law that wasn't constructed for adoptions. When you look at the UCCJEA, it regards custody and visitation, and I used to do a lot of custody work years ago. And we're talking about older children. We're talking about children of divorce. We're talking about children of broken up families. We're talking about children whose parental rights are being terminated through the state of Oregon. Adoption is different. Not all adoptions, but a great number of adoptions involve newborns. And the UCCJEA is less instructive and doesn't have the jurisdictional tags that we need when we're dealing with adoptions, which are truly unique compared to custody and visitation cases. So I hope that would help answer your question from before.
I think that all your comments are helpful. I think what I'll do is ask Senator Walker, Senator Farioli, to form a work group here in the interest of parties and see if they can come to some resolution on the bill. If not, the bill dies. If they do, then the bill will proceed. And hopefully all of the attorneys can get together and find a reasonable solution. This is an Oregon State Bar bill, so it's interesting that these types of bills, adoption, family law, always tend to bring controversy, notwithstanding the fact they're a bar bill. So usually bar bills are kind of zip right on through here, kind of thing, but not these. So if that's okay with you, Senator Walker.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have a... I'd like to get this issue resolved in the next several weeks, if possible. So.
I would, too. So I will work with Senator Farioli's schedule, and rather just having come to my office, what we'll do is find a mutual time that we can get together for about an hour.
I'd love to. And and yes, I'd love to sit down and talk.
And there's some folks I need to contact who I work with in the adoption movement as well, so I might bring them in.
The other thing I'll do, I'm going to ask Mr. Joseph to do a little bit of research on legislative history and find out what happened in 1999, pull the records and see if we can make sure we're not doing something that was contrary to your specific intent by the committee steps.
And if it were next week, it would also give us the opportunity, next week or later, it would give us the opportunity. And I'm always happy to talk to Ellen. But Ellen, who I have enormous respect for, she and I do disagree on lots and lots of stuff. So I'm always happy to talk to Ellen whether or not we're able to come to any solution.
Well,
it's truly an open question.
I will defer to Senator Farioli and Senator Walker on their judgment on where we should go from there.
And it won't be this week. I'm on four committees.
I appreciate that.
Time.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you very much. We'll close the hearing. Senate Bill 38, and we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 39. Hopefully we have a sign-up sheet. We have a couple of them seem to know that they're at the top. There we go. Dan Olson and Stephanie Smith. Right? Who's going to go first?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dan Olson, here representing the Executive Committee of the Government Law Section. Just for the record, I'll indicate that I'm also Washington County Council, but I'm not representing the county here nor the board. They've not taken a position on this matter at all. The government law section includes a lot of in-house government attorneys, a lot of private practitioners who both represent local governments and also make a good living suing us as well. So we have a fairly diverse membership, and the section normally does not get involved in the legislative process, particularly for that reason and because we also represent political bodies. But we do, from time to time, focus on what we consider to be minor law improvement or housekeeping bills that will hopefully avoid the risk of litigation in the future and just make everyone's life easier and save the taxpayers some money. We believe that Senate Bill 39 is such a bill. It's, I think, fairly well described in the handout, and I'll just briefly highlight what it does. As I'm sure the committee knows, the legislature has adopted evidentiary privileges against disclosure of certain communications, doctor, patient, spousal, so on and so forth. And those are available to individuals, to corporations, and to government, and in particular the attorney-client privilege is one available to governments. The legislature has also adopted the open meetings law that says in general we have to meet in public, but there are some exceptions, including the ability to meet in executive session with counsel to discuss litigation. And that those discussions are to be confidential. The press is entitled to attend, but not to report. And they serve as a watchdog on the process through their attendance to make sure that we're staying within the bounds of the law. The problem that we have discovered is that the statutes on the attorney-client privilege, or all the privileges actually, state that the privilege is waived if you voluntarily disclose to a third party the substance of the communication. And then the statute lists those things that are not voluntary disclosures, and the attendance of the media in an executive session isn't listed there. So it's not listed as one of the things that's not a disclosure. Ergo, we feel that it's open for an argument that attendance by the media constitutes a waiver of the attorney-client privilege. Has that been argued? Not to our knowledge. I can say from personal experience, though, in talking with others, when we've brought in outside counsel to assist us, say, on a bankruptcy or whatever, and they come to our board and they look around and they see the press there, the first thing they do is freeze up because they are very concerned about waiver of the privilege, and we have to kind of explain to them that we think it's okay. And what we would like to do, what this bill proposes to do, is just sort of close that loop, if you will. We think we would prevail in court if and when the issue goes to a judge, but we also think that that it would be contrary to the policy and the intent of both the privilege statutes and the public meetings laws to have this be a waiver, and that we'd end up spending a lot of time and taxpayer money arguing about it in front of a judge. A judge may look at the literal wording of the statute, as sometimes they are prone to do, and say, gee, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me either, but you lose. And that would create a significant problem for local governments in Oregon. So we consider this a proactive, in some ways maybe a belt and suspenders measure that we think as a committee would be a simple law improvement. I, It is my understanding that Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspapers Association, has graciously indicated that they have no problem with this measure. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Stephanie Smythe.
All right, Ms. Smith.
Good morning, Chair Minnis and members of the committee. I'm Stephanie Smythe. I'm also representing the Oregon State Bar Government Law Section. I am a member of the Department of Justice, attorney in charge of the Business Transactions Section, but I'm not speaking on behalf of the Department of Justice, which has not considered this bill. I would just simply add that the purpose of the bill is to fill a gap and to promote the two purposes of the evidence code and the public meetings law, and it connects them together in a better way, so it's law improvement. Clearly, the purpose of the public meetings law is to encourage frank discussions between attorneys and government bodies in executive session. That's one of the legitimate purposes of having an executive session, and also to encourage media attendance at those sessions. That public purpose, when it meets with the public purpose of the evidence code, which allows for voluntary disclosure, comes to a little bit of a point of dilemma. So we're trying to fill the gap between the two of them. The problem that I'd like to point out is that the current state of the law does inhibit the candid and frank discussion between attorneys and their clients that are government clients when an executive session is held. And it may have the effect of discouraging attorneys from being as frank as they should be. They may be encouraged instead to hold private sidebar discussions with individual members of governing bodies, which is not, we think, the best solution. The better solution is to have that discussion in the executive session itself, so all the members of the governing body can hear it at once and interact with the attorneys about that advice or discussion, and so the media can also hear it. And in fact, the worst case scenario would be that attorneys would avoid any candid discussion at all about sensitive matters, such as the negative aspects of a case against a governing body that is in litigation and should be settled. So we think that this would promote good public policy and be good government, and that's the reason that the government law section is behind the bill.
All right. It may be good government, but it's relatively complex language. So help me understand the lines of reference for 14. Of course, the voluntary disclosure does not occur when representatives of news media are allowed to attend executive session of the governing body. Public body is provided in 192.66-3. Then I get a little bit more confused with the next part. Or when representatives of the news media disclose information after the governing body has prohibited disclosure of information. What does that mean?
Senator Minnis, that under the current law, the media is allowed to attend, and the statute states that they are not to disclose. There are, however, no sanctions if a media does disclose. So it can happen. It could happen intentionally or it could happen inadvertently. And what this language does is say that if it does get disclosed, either intentionally or inadvertently, by a newspaper person, you know, they're free to print it in the newspaper. The public knows what's going on, but for purposes of evidence in the courtroom, the judge or a jury cannot consider it because we did not voluntarily disclose it. The fact that the media was there is what made the disclosure. I also might point out that we're talking about executive sessions here for litigation. Now, if for some reason the discussion strayed beyond that and was outside the scope of the executive session, then that's a different issue. We're talking about communications with counsel regarding ordinarily litigation. There might be occasional other matters that counsel would advise the local government on.
Well, okay, so you raised a couple other issues. So help me understand if I'm understanding this. If I'm a news person, I'm sitting in an executive session, there's certain things I cannot disclose. But what this is saying is that if I inadvertently disclose or intentionally disclose it later at some subsequent process, litigation, that would be not allowed as evidence, correct? Okay. Help me understand. You said it would be published in the press, it would be known by the public, but when it got into the trial situation, the judge would not allow that information into the trial. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so I'm thinking about how the media generally works. They sit in on meetings. or when I talk to them, sometimes you say, well, this is off the record. I give them a little bit of information. And then what they do is they run around and they confirm that information with someone else. Okay, so then they subsequently confirm it. It ends up in the press. Aren't we creating a problem there in that now we wouldn't be able or potentially could not introduce information into evidence at trial that was gained lawfully?
Senator Minnis, you raised a very good question. In fact, that's one that we discussed with Mr. Gallagher. What may typically happen is that a newspaper reporter will be in the executive session, hear something, and not report it from the executive session, but hear it from someone else. Someone, maybe a member of the governing body or a staff person, makes the comment outside of executive session. And that's fair game. That is a voluntary disclosure. And the judge, in those cases, the judge would be faced potentially with having to decide, did the reporter disclose from the executive session or did the reporter have another source? And typically what the reporter would say, would tell us, and I think in most cases we would have no reason to doubt him, he would say, I didn't take that from the executive session, I had another source, in which case we'd be stuck with the disclosure. That would be a voluntary disclosure. Right. What we're talking about are those situations where, in the second part of this language, which are very rare, where there is an intentional or inadvertent disclosure by the press of material from the executive session that was not intended to be disclosed.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, doesn't it also apply once you breach the attorney-client privilege? Then isn't it fair game? Can't they ask you in court expansion of the information? Wouldn't this help protect against that as well?
That's correct, Senator Burdick. That would be an additional concern on the part of the attorneys representing governments, is that it opens the door to disclosure of advice that relates to the topic under discussion that may have occurred outside the executive session as well.
Another question. You talk about litigation strategy being the subject of this bill, but there's also attorney-client privilege, I believe, that prevails in labor negotiations. Would this apply to that as well?
That is a special exception to the allowance of media at executive sessions. They are not permitted by law to attend executive sessions on labor negotiations. So this would, unless the governing body permits them in, they would not be at such sessions.
But if the governing body did permit, and I think I have that section right in front of me, mm-hmm. if they did let them in, then would this bill apply in those circumstances as well?
I don't believe so, because this says when the news media are allowed to attend as provided in ORS 192-6603, and they would not be allowed to attend under 6603 such sessions.
And you have this law, this provision, which is basically unenforceable, has been in effect for, I think, over 25 years, and you've known of no cases where people have tried to breach the privilege?
We do not have any case law that's been reported at the appellate level of that kind of thing occurring. And I think, as Mr. Olson said earlier, it is fairly rare for the media to abuse the privilege of attending the executive session by making disclosures. The law, they respect the ability to attend those sessions and recognize that it would not be in their own interest to abuse the privilege. So we don't have examples that I can cite to you of cases where it's been abused.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, however, I would point out that I have had cases where we've had outside counsel come in and say, gee, I'm not really comfortable talking about this in executive session. So they hedge what they have to say, and then they end up meeting individually with the elected officials or asking me to relay something or putting it in writing rather than discussing it. So it's just sort of an inhibiting factor, and we also just think it's inevitable that someone will come up with this argument and we'll have to deal with it.
All right. Other questions? Senator Ringo.
I have not had that much direct dealing with how, say, a city council or school board works. I've not been on one, or a county commission. So I'd like to know a little bit more about when groups like that go into executive sessions, and what is the reason to go into executive session is to keep the public out. It's to, because it's sensitive and it's private, and they want to keep it secret. I'm curious as to why and when the press would be allowed, if it is a secret subject, that you've made an exception, at least in the one case of labor negotiations. Could you explain that, please? Because that's, I guess, my next question is going to be, well, if it's so secret, why is the press there? And if it's so important to have an attorney there, why isn't that an issue that you might want to say, well, this is like labor negotiations. It's something that we deem confidential.
Chairman Menas, Senator Ringo, the examples that we would most normally come across where counsel are present or counsel are involved, and this bill would apply to our litigation, personnel disciplinary matters, discussing with the Board of County Commissioners discipline or in the school board, same thing, perhaps real estate negotiations where you don't want the other side to know what your position or what your bottom line might be, and the attorney is handling the negotiations or advising on some of the legal issues related to real estate. There are other examples, but those are probably the most common ones involving attorneys. In terms of the presence of the media, quite frankly, that's just something that, you know, we've learned to live with, and I personally don't have a problem with it at all, in part because there are times when we just sort of naturally stray out in that discussion, stray outside the bounds of the parameters of the executive session, and I'll occasionally say, gee, I think we've gone too far here. And other times, the representatives from the media will stand up and say, you guys are getting a little far afield here. I think I can be reporting this. And so I don't really have a problem with them being there. We've had good relationships with our newspaper people. I think it's just I personally don't have a problem with the public policy behind that.
Follow-up question?
Well, I guess just a comment, and I'd like your reaction to it. You know, in law school, and you go to ethics CLEs, I mean, they really hold the attorney-client privilege up as sacred. And, you know, people go to jail over that, and the attorney-client privilege is something that I think we have to take very, very seriously. And it concerns me a little bit that this erodes the sanctity of that privilege, in that it says, well, now we are letting a third person listen, and it's not just any third person. It happens to be the media. And I understand all the reasons you proposed, but I guess I am somewhat concerned that it erodes the privilege a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, a client will come to my office and say, oh, I brought my friend with me. Is that okay? I say, no, it's not okay. If you want our conversation to be secret, your friend has to stay outside. You know, and I don't tell my wife about conversations between me and a client. I mean, you have to take that very, very seriously. And now we're saying, well, in this case, we are going to allow a third person in. And I am concerned about that.
Senator Ringer, if I understand this correctly, really what we're trying to do is restate or make more clear what is already the expectation. So I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I'm assuming that most attorneys, if they feel like there's going to be a potential breach of that attorney-client privilege, they're going to do exactly what has been suggested. They're going to say, I don't feel comfortable talking about this
right here,
and do what they currently do now.
Right.
This really does not give an attorney a higher level of comfort necessarily. At least if I was an attorney, I wouldn't feel that comfortable unless I really knew the media well and personally trusted them. I also noted here there may be some level of potential malpractice. You know, if an attorney did in fact trust someone too much or run off.
Well, it would be a breach of their professional responsibilities, that's for sure.
Chairman, it's Senator Ringo, that's why we're here, quite frankly. The law is and has been for many, many years that the media is allowed to attend. We have no choice on that. What we're trying to do is make it clear that attendance does not breach our attorney-client privilege by definition, and to strengthen that so we are more comfortable with the ability to maintain that privilege in the courtroom at least.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could just provide a little perspective on this. I've actually followed this law from its inception from the other side of the table as a reporter, and the reason that the executive session provision was put in there was to address exactly the issue that Mr. Olson referred to, and that is bodies getting a quorum together to discuss, say, litigation or something that is very sensitive, and then while they're at it, going ahead and making decisions in that closed setting in violation of the spirit of the open meeting law. If there's no press in there, no one outside to watch, then no one knows what's happening. And the criterion is if they're deliberating toward a decision that is not covered in executive session. I sit on a board right now, the Police, Fire, and Pension and Disability board in Portland, and it oftentimes comes up where we'll be talking about a personnel matter in executive session and start to wander afield, and the mayor says, nope, we got to get out of executive session if we're going to discuss this. So to have the press in there in executive session is a protection for the public interest, if you will. And the requirements for a public body are different than for a private attorney. The ground rules are different. The public has an interest in everything they do, in litigation, in personnel, in land acquisitions, the whole thing. The public has an interest in this. It's just because of the circumstance, it would be disruptive to have everything out in these sensitive negotiations. So I think that this provision of the open meeting law basically runs on good faith. If you had a reporter or a bunch of reporters who were just dead set to stretch the limits, violate the executive, we could have a real mess, but it's worked for 25 years, and I think that really speaks well for all concerned. I don't think this language would provide a guarantee if someone were to really set their mind to cause a problem. But I think this definitely adds some legislative history and adds some intent and adds some possibly security to people who might be participating in these. And I commend you for kind of seeing this ahead of a problem. So, thank you.
And currently, there's no cause of action that occurs if there's a breach of this statute. Correct.
Chairman, you mean by the press?
Well, or the county government, or any government. Can you then sue the press for breach of this?
No. There's no enforcement mechanism for the press. There is an enforcement mechanism for local governments if they violate the executive session
statute.
So
one direction we could go is to add a cause of action for breach and treble damages. That would be an issue of the First Amendment.
I think, Mr. Chairman, again, the main purpose of this bill, quite frankly, is not the disclosure. It's the attendance, really, that's the problem. The mere attendance is what raises the main concern.
I know, and I don't mean to start off. All right, committee's comfort level with the bill?
I'm fine.
All right. We'll do a work session on Senate Bill 39.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
I move that we send Senate Bill 39 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. So Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 39 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation and discussion. There's no discussion. Any objections to the motion? No objections. Passes, and I'll ask the Senate to bring this bill on the floor, and I assume that other members may have questions about it. So.
Thank you.
And any other business before the committee? If not, we are adjourned.
Are Friday's good days for you?
General, not this one.
No, not this one. That's great.
Sure. Okay. Why don't you, if your service comes,
yes, it is.
But Fridays are my best day of the week because the rest of the week sucks.
Okay.
And that seems to be a good day for those folks.